is Local Talk, a show that explores the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. We're your hosts today, Greta Anderson
and Deborah Bunka.
Today we profile Practical Farmers of Iowa, or PFI, a farmer organization in its 28th year, which is having its annual conference in Ames later this week.
Howdy, neighbor!
Howdy, neighbor!
Happy harvest! May your 40 acres soon be fields of clover!
Bought myself a farm way out in the country. Took to growing lettuce, milk, and cows and honey. Bought myself a farm.
Day and night I work my fingers to the bone. On this piece of land I live my whole life on. Well, there ain't no time for fun.
I don't know, Debbie. I'm having difficulty choosing a theme song for this show. It's hard to pigeonhole PFI. Its membership and their interests and approaches are so diverse.
I know what you mean. You definitely don't want to use some slick country song by some guy who has no idea what nitrogen-fixing bacteria are.
Or some woe is me, acre by acre, they're taking our farmland away because we're selling out song.
Yeah, the members aren't into pointing fingers. They're more about digging in and finding solutions.
Well, why don't I just start with a piece of your interview with Teresa Opheim? She'll get us off on the right foot.
Sounds good to me. This is Local Talk. I'm Deborah Bunka, and today I'm talking with Teresa Opheim, Executive Director of the Practical Farmers of Iowa. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Deborah.
We want to talk about your conference coming up, Soil and the Soul, and we would like to learn a lot about practical farmers. So let's begin by talking a little bit about the history of the organization. When were you founded?
Practical Farmers of Iowa was started in 1985 by farmers near Boone, Dick and Sharon Thompson, who worked with another person, Larry Callum, to get this group going. And we focused on farmer-to-farmer networking through the entire history of this group. Farmers learn very well from other farmers. They're very practical. They like to explore things and try them out on their own farms before they decide that something is worthwhile pursuing. We have done a lot of on-farm research where there are randomized, replicated trials. Rick Exner, who is an Ames resident, was just absolutely critical through the years in getting our program started and getting farmers involved and doing all kinds of different research. We also do a lot of demonstration projects and record-keeping projects so that farmers can really get a good idea, for example, of their costs. Right now we have an energy program where we're trying to help them figure out their total energy use and costs and CO2 emissions and then take steps to reduce it, that kind of project as well.
So this information that's derived from these from this research, is it shared amongst all the farmers?
Yes. Well, it is shared amongst PFI members and then also with farmers around the state and beyond. We had more than 86 events last year, field days, online seminars, workshops, all these places we work on getting the word out about the research and demonstration that our farmers have done.
There really is a lot of knowledge that you have to have to be a farmer. These are people that are businessmen and women. They've got to run a real operation.
That's a good observation. Essentially, a farmer is a small businessman or woman, and so needs to be adept at all kinds of different skills. So we work on not only the production aspects, which is really why most of them are farming. They want to grow things and be around livestock. But we also work with them on marketing issues and business planning issues because they won't succeed without figuring those aspects out as well. It all just depends on what the farmers want us most to focus on. We spend a great deal of time trying to get feedback from them so that we can do the programming that they want most. We're very farmer-directed. And
I was just going to say I'd like to just talk about that for a minute, because that is really so important for our audience to know that you are farmer-directed.
That's absolutely right. 10 out of the 12 board members we have are farmers. So that helps us keep very focused on what farmers want. And then we do all this surveying and have a lot of feedback loops so that we make sure we're focusing on what they want. So we don't decide for them what they should do. They tell us what they want to do.
As Teresa mentioned, Practical Farmers of Iowa got its start back in 1985 after a visit by Larry Callum to Dick and Sharon Thompson's farm. On January 1st of this year, I sat at the Thompson's kitchen table and asked the three of them to fill out the story a little. Larry spoke first.
Practical Farmers of Iowa was started in 1985 at a time when farmers were under great economic pressure to try to help them farm in lower cost ways, but at the same time in ways that were friendly to the land and to the people on it. The organization essentially was created in order to pick up on a philosophy and a way of farming that Dick Thompson had been showing to the community on his own for some years. I had originally come to one of his field days just to explore, to see what he was doing. The thing that impressed me, that made me think this was something that ought to be spread around more, that ought to be encouraged, was that he had a philosophy that was based on science. I mean, there have always been people around the countryside in agriculture, particularly on the fringes of agriculture, who have this wonderful idea, some product or another, and they said it was really wonderful. They would bring you people that would give testimonials for it. There was never any scientific basis for it. You had to take it on faith. Here was a guy, Dick Thompson, who did randomized, replicated plots side by side, and he had nothing to sell. In fact, when we started out basing the philosophy of this, Dick and I talked about those kinds of things. This organization would never encourage the use of any particular product. We would never get involved in such things. And there are other parts of the philosophy, too. Dick, you want to tell us about what you think is important?
Well, I'd like to share an experience about what he's talking about. The thing that changed his farm was a Wonderlife meeting, a product meeting.
Wonderlife.
Yes, that was the name of their product. It was marine sediment out of a lake out in Colorado. The only thing I found that really responded was the night crawlers. When we would unload these bags and put them in a shed, the dust would fall out, and the night crawlers they had something to eat. Well, anyway, I don't remember how many years I used the product, but I left the space that I didn't put any on and took the yields. There wasn't any different. And so that led to more experiences that we got involved with Rodale.
Rodale Organic Gardening Institute.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
yes.
And that's over in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, Robert Rodale sat on that at that table for supper.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Anyway, the editor of the New Farm magazine wanted me to check out Basic H. That was another product.
And this is a Rodale publication, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And so that didn't show anything. So that that led to doing more plots, more replications.
As I mentioned, I had been at a field day that Dick had hosted 1 year. My work at the time, and was for 25 years, was as the head of an organization for farmer cooperatives. And as part of my work, it was necessary for me in doing educational programming to try to get an idea of what's on the horizon, what kinds of trends are developing out there on the farming front. And I heard about this. I heard about this field day, Dick's field day. I came out here and watched him take the flat rack around the farm, showing the different fields, explaining what he was testing on this plot, what was going on right next to it, and what the results were. And the combination of all of that, the scientific background, the way of going about it, the continuing felt need that he had to pick those kinds of practices that were good to the land, that all got me an enthusiasm. And I asked him if he would be on my annual meeting program for the Iowa Institute for Cooperatives in Ames. And he was. He did a fine job, and the people there were fascinated. Sharon was there, too. The two of them put on a presentation about what they were doing out on the farm, showed the pictures and everything. And after that was over, I asked Dick. I says, Dick, this seems to me like something that needs to be showcased, that needs to be spread. Would you be interested in starting an organization with me that would do this? Well, he said, I'm going to be on this biological farming conference at Iowa State coming up. It may have been the next day even. He says, I will ask them if they would have an interest in an organization.
You weren't there.
I wasn't even there.
Yeah.
I had something else I had to do. So he asked them, and then we got together again. He said, I got a really good response. So then we got a hold of Rick Exner and some of the other people who were on the steering committee. We did a bus tour around the state. That's to say the speakers were on the bus. We got an agronomist from Rodale. We had an ag engineer from Iowa State. We had a farm management guy from Northern Iowa, from Spencer. And we put on a program. All of these things were advertised over the farm radio stations in the state because I knew these people. So we had crowds there that come to these hotels. So Dick and Sharon would put on part of the program. The ag engineer from Iowa State would talk about something that he was interested in. The farm management guy would say, well, what's the difference between a farm that makes money and one that doesn't? And people came to that sort of thing. And then at the very end of the program, I would be the last speaker, and I would say, we're going to start this organization. Would you want to be a part? We ended up with 300 members at the end of that tour, and that's how we got started. My wife became the first secretary of the organization. I was its staff guy, and Dick provided the stuff that everybody was interested in seeing. He's the message, and we essentially built the foundation around that message. And from the very beginning, we had support from a well-positioned professor at Iowa State, too. I mean, this was scientific stuff. A relationship with Iowa State was important and very helpful. And not everybody at the time thought that Iowa State was doing such a wonderful job with some of the things it recommended for agriculture. They were looking for something different from Iowa State. And there were people at Iowa State who felt the same need. And that's essentially how we took that niche, you might say. You can't solve everything with spraying it or covering it with fertilizer, essentially, is the point. And you don't usually end up making a whole lot of money, particularly if you're not a huge farming operation.
The other system wasn't working. I was raising continuous corn, and I went to this Wonder Life meeting, and the farmer said that if you're raising continuous corn, you're going down a blind alley. And boy, that was a two-before experience for me. I didn't sleep that night. We made a drastic change in our rotation back to close to what my father had, and instead of buying cattle and buying feeder pigs, well, something told me that where the money to be made in livestock is when you have a cow and has a calf, and you take the calf and finish it. You do the whole program, because most of the money is in the cow herd. So it was changing our rotation from continuous corn to corn and soybeans and oats and hay.
Back to the old days.
Right.
Well, but this is different. Some people initially saw PFI as an organization simply wanted people to go back 30 or 40 years, but that was not the point at all. The idea is know what you're doing and why. Get it documented. Why should it be this way rather than that way? Come to find out that some people years ago had the right idea. Didn't necessarily know themselves why they were doing it right, because they didn't have any documentation either. But it all changed for a variety of reasons, perhaps. Some say, well, it's the universities, the land-grant colleges that ran us down that path that got us into the high-volume, high-expense habit. And others would say, no, it's the big chemical companies and the machinery companies that promoted all this. But that's just pointing fingers. Essentially, the farmers took people's word for things they should have found out for themselves on their own farm, and that's what Dick was doing.
The absolutely most wonderful thing about this organization, in my mind, is the diversity of people who are involved. We have large corn soybean farmers who have 3, 4, 5,000 acres down to 2-acre vegetable operations, and those who want to start vegetable operations. We have non-farmers involved. We have conventional farmers, organic farmers, those who raise animals completely on grass, those who have animals on feedlots. All kinds of different people come together. Not only are they different in their enterprises, but I've discovered in my 6.5 years on the job that they're extremely different in their political and religious philosophies as well. But they still all come together in this group, which I think is pretty astounding in this day and age. Given that diversity in the membership, it would be very difficult for us to decide on too many specific policy initiatives to focus on. So we have a pretty limited policy role. However, we have a very strong effort going to try and get more conservation funding for things like cover crops or more extended rotations. We're also involved in beginning farmer programming and funding on the federal level for programs that help farms diversify.
And again, that's farmer-driven?
Yes, our policy committee is a group. There are maybe one or two non-farmers, but mainly farmers on that.
They come up with recommendations which are then approved by our executive committee of farmers so that we make sure that we stay focused exactly on what the organization wants. I think our policy role will increase slowly but steadily, but it'll stay very targeted in the places where we can be most effective, which is providing feedback on specific programs, what policies, what practices should be funded within those programs.
Are you touching on the Farm Bill at all? That's a very hot topic right now.
In the Farm Bill, for example, we will be asking for very robust funding for beginning farmer programs, for conservation programs, and those will be our focus.
So basically what you're saying, as I understand it, is that the organization Practical Farmers of Iowa is there to support the choices of farmers and to facilitate knowledge exchange.
That's exactly right. I think it's very difficult to decide what is sustainable or what is resilient for any individual. We don't issue a mandate saying you have to do this to be a sustainable farmer. We're all on a journey towards sustainability. Some of us are further along on the economic sustainability, and some are further along on stewardship sustainability. But we really feel that all of these farmers have a lot to teach each other, and that's why they keep coming, and that's why the organization keeps growing.
It's interesting to me, looking back on it, to see what kind of people the organization has attracted. It's a source of great satisfaction to me. It's people that have a high value system, that do care about their neighbors, that care about the land, who tend to have a strong faith. Now, whether it's a particular denomination or not, we don't know, we don't care, we don't even talk about that. We just know there's a certain faith and value system of all that's common to us when we're in PFI. This is not unique to Iowa agriculture. I mean, typically speaking, farmers are in some fashion religious people because they're so close to the land and they know so much of it is beyond their control. And so essentially it's based on the need to be practical, to do those things which you find out by research will keep you in business, that will be good to the land so it will still produce for you 20 years from now, just like it did for you, and also be good to the neighbors. You don't want to do as you've seen some of your neighbors do, who build their farms by cash renting, by going around to some absentee landowners, people who don't farm, or whose kids now have, through the estate, have gotten a farm, and telling them you will pay them $10 more or $50 more per acre cash rent than the guy who's got it now. Won't you rent it to me? I mean, that kind of competition has essentially torn out a lot of the heart of agriculture, a lot of the neighborliness that used to be there. Not to say there's none now, but it's not like it used to be. The fabric has been torn over the years.
That Wendell Berry says that do you want the neighbor's farm or do you want the neighbor?
That's
which is
close.
More important to you, having a neighbor or his farm?
Yeah. And the idea then for us has been to share what we find out. I mean, we start out as being an organization that shares experiences. We learn from each other from what we do. But the stuff we do is based on scientific experimentation, so what we say, we can prove. And when we share it, it's something that that person can take with confidence and say, that's worth trying. That sounds good to me.
How many members does PFI have?
Oh, it's going up rather rapidly lately. It's something like, what, 3,000 or 4,000, something like
that? Well, yeah. It all depends if you're counting all the kids.
It does, but I think even just counting the number of farms, it's a good deal higher than it was.
Oh, yes, I'm sure of that. Yeah.
That's right. It's a family-oriented organization.
You know, that's an interesting thing, too. As I mentioned, I really like what I see when I notice who comes. This is one of the very few, if not the only organization, where I've gone to their meetings where you actually see little kids there. Young families. For the most part, when you go to meetings of farm organizations, these are old guys. These are 50s, 60s, and 70s that are in farming in other organizations. But we got the young folk, people who are trying very hard to be practical, to stay on the farm, to get started in farming, and they need the stuff they can find in the organization, and that's what it's for.
Bought myself a farm way out in the country, took to growing lettuce, milk, and cows, and honey. Bought myself.
We now have more than 1,300 people who say they want to farm. They're not all young. Some have some experience behind them. But they all have come to this group to get more information on production, on business planning, the variety of things that they'll need to do to get started on farming. So one thing that we did was establish a program called the Savings Incentive Program, and that program matches a beginning farmer with a mentor so that they can learn from the experienced farmers in our network. And the program also helps them develop a business plan and matches their savings so that they have a good start on purchasing a farm asset after they graduate. We have a land linking website where those who own farmland can get on and register their farmland, and those seeking farmland can get on as well and see if we can make some connections there. We've had a couple matches in that regard. About a quarter of our members are non-farmers. Many of them own farmland, and that's how they came to this group. So we have sessions, we do networking for those people. We're exploring whether we should even offer some kind of consulting service for farmland owners who want to do something beyond corn and soybeans on their farmland. There are just all kinds of connections that are going to need to happen for the next generation to succeed, especially with these high land prices that they're seeing.
Speaking of networking, PFI is also active in the local foods movement, connecting producers with consumers who appreciate the quality of food straight from the farm.
Chicks are gonna cackle, and every burlap sack will be full of taters and tobaccos and dozens of different good and healthy greens. And if the weatherman won't upset us, mister, you can bet us there'll be lots of crispy lettuce in your jeans. Into live and find out just what living means. Howdy, neighbor.
Happy harvest.
Happy harvest. May your 40 acres.
Practical Farmers of Iowa has a long tradition of serving food that we purchase directly from our farmers for our conference. And so we will be doing that again this year at the Saturday lunch at the conference. We purchase food directly from our farmers for all of our events. In fact, last year we purchased $70,000 directly from farmers for our field days, for the conference, for other workshops. We started purchasing food directly from the farmers for the conference a long time ago. I'm not even sure how many years ago, but I remember going to a conference 12 years or so ago where we had purchased the food directly from the farmers. And we continue to do that. And we also have seen that all kinds of other conferences and other events are now sourcing food locally as well.
We have done a study helping some non-farmers increase their local food purchases, and we're really interested in doing more of that over the years. What does it take to get from shopping at the farmer's market just a couple times over the summer or those summer months to actually spending a good deal of your food dollar supporting farmers directly? In my household, we spend about 60% of our food dollars on local food purchases. Before this study, where we actually track this information in detail, we thought it was higher than that. So what else could we do as a family and as Iowans to really support farmers directly and make it easier for them to sell to consumers directly and get almost all, if not all, of their food dollar?
Harvest bells are gonna chime. Remember, neighbor, when you work for Mother Nature, you get paid by the time.
My name is Helen Gunderson, and I live here in Ames. I grew up in Northwest Iowa, fourth generation farm family. I've belonged to PFI for 17 years. It's been helpful to me as an absentee landowner, as an urban farmer, as a consumer of local foods. And going to the annual meeting for many years has felt like coming home. I moved back to Iowa in about 1993 and had been working on a project about the road I grew up on and exploring my rural neighborhood and doing interviews. And I had never heard of PFI. I don't even think I knew Rick Exner at the time, but I got a call from Rick Exner asking me if I would come do a mini exhibit of my project at the PFI annual meeting. I like the fact that they respect all of us. There's the annual conference, and then there's the annual cooperators meeting, which is for PFI members who are actually doing in-field research. And they have an evening dinner, and after the meal's over, they have somebody go around with a microphone to each person in the room who stands up and says their name and a little bit about what's on their cutting-edge interest. So this one year, I said that I had learned about the concept of cloning apple trees, and that there was an 85-year-old wealthy apple tree at my grandparents' farm, which we call the home place. It's an abandoned farm. And I was wondering if anybody would be willing to go up there with me and get wood and graft, you know, some trees for me. Wealthy is a heritage variety of apple that is supposed to be good in our cold north central areas, developed in the late 1800s. So the meal was over there, and I was sitting politely, maybe following up on conversation with somebody, and Tom Wall came over and spoke to me. I'd never met him before. He is a tree specialist in southeast Iowa, deals with pawpaws and hazelnuts and chestnuts and fruit trees. And he said, "Tell me about your wealthy tree." And he said, "I'd be willing to help you learn how to do it."
And how has PFI helped you as a landlord?
Well, I have 500 acres of land that has been in our family for a long time and farmed in the industrial model of agriculture. And it's taken me a long time to realize I could manage that myself. 3 or 4 years ago, I started renting to a young woman to farm a third of my land and transition it to organic. And so I got a lot of advice on how to build the lease on that. And in some ways, as an absentee landowner, there's not a lot I learn because you go to workshops and right away they get much more in depth than I can understand. And yet, if I go to a workshop on organic practices, I realize some of the challenges that my tenant faces. The neatest thing about going to PFI events is the All Iowa Meals, and admired PFI's leadership in that area. They actually used to have somebody on staff who was the local foods coordinator. And over the years, I often thought, wouldn't it be neat to do something on this order? But I didn't really have an avenue for doing it. I suppose it was no coincidence that about the time I moved to Ames in 2006, it was easier to be a volunteer at my church. And that winter, somebody asked me if I'd be the soup lunch coordinator. And I don't think she ever envisioned where I might take this, nor did I envision where I might take it. But that spring, I was talking to some people, and I said, "Hey, why don't we do an Iowa meal next fall?" And Linda Barnes, who's a member of PFI, was really active in that. And so we've had our 7th annual one this year. I think it's something that every congregation could do in some way or another.
Iowa, Iowa, Iowa.
Anderson, and this is Local Talk. The topic of today's show is Practical Farmers of Iowa, or PFI. Since the relationship with ISU researchers is such an important part of PFI, I was eager to hear about some of their work. We'll hear now from two different scientists, both named Matt, whose work will be showcased at the upcoming conference, January 10th through 12th.
I'm here with Matt Liebman of Iowa State University. Matt has been awarded the Sustainable Ag Achievement Award of 2013 by Practical Farmers of Iowa and will receive that award during this upcoming annual meeting. Matt, could you describe what your research is about?
Well, I'm interested in ways that we can have profitable and productive farming systems that are in harmony with the environment. A lot of the health of our soil and the functioning of our ecosystem prior to the time of farming this area was related to the fact that we had plants that grew for most of the year that occupied the soil with very deep roots and that did a very good job intercepting sunlight and providing habitat for wildlife and preventing floods and maintaining itself through droughts. I'm involved in two projects. One down in Jasper County at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge, where they've created the largest reconstructed tall grass prairie in the United States. We have strips of reconstructed prairie woven in to areas that are being cropped by a commercial farmer with corn and soybean. Then we have some other experimental plots in Garden Township in Boone County, north of Madrid, where we've been comparing the use of prairie versus corn for biofuel production. The basic thing that we're thinking about is that we're not just maximizing the production of one thing, like corn grain or ethanol. We want to optimize the production of multiple things so that we want to store carbon in the soil, and we want to protect water quality, and we want to provide habitat for wildlife, and we want to grow enough food, and we want to generate enough profit. By taking a more, I'll call it an optimization approach rather than a maximization approach, we kind of have to enlarge the range of things that we keep track of. I work with a group of people who keep track of things like songbirds and insects that provide pollination and biological control of pest services. And if you provide habitat, many more things come to live than what you often find in just corn and soybean fields. And the fact is that they move between the reconstructed prairie strips and the adjacent cropland. So perennial vegetation provides perennial habitat for what we call natural enemies of crop pests. So the things that parasitize or feed upon pests like soybean aphid can be fostered by having perennial habitat around for them. The flowers provide nectar and pollen for many natural enemies, and the structure that perennial vegetation provides, places to hide, places to overwinter, is important for maintaining the populations of songbirds and beneficial insects. What we've found is that if we put 10% of a watershed that's otherwise occupied by corn and soybean, if we put 10% of it into prairie, we can reduce the export of soil sediment out of the bottom of the watershed by 95%.
That's amazing.
So that's huge. Yeah. And we also get more water infiltrating into the soil rather than running off and creating a flash in the adjacent streams, which makes for flooding downstream. The prairie strip experiments, corn and soybean are grown in rotation in the areas that are not in the prairie strips. Other experiments that I'm working with have corn and soybean grown in rotation with oats and alfalfa, or oats and clover. And those plants are legumes that take atmospheric nitrogen and put it in their roots through an association with a bacterium. When they break down, when their residues are incorporated into the soil, they release a lot of that nitrogen for crops like corn. And we've been able to reduce our fertilizer inputs, depending on the year, up to 100% relative to a regular corn and soybean rotation that gets commercial fertilizer. So that's a nice way to reduce our reliance on synthetic fertilizer. We also find that when we use alfalfa and clover and small grains like oat in rotation with corn and soybean, we can dramatically reduce the amount of herbicide we would otherwise apply to control weeds in a corn soybean system. So we've been able to reduce our herbicide inputs 96-97% and get equivalent weed control relative to what we get in conventional corn and soybean systems.
The rotation experiment that you described sounds a lot like what Dick Thompson described doing on his farm.
Yeah, in fact, I had met Dick at various functions before I moved to Iowa, and then when I got to Iowa in 1998, I spent a portion of the summer sitting in his tractor cab while he was cultivating, while he was explaining what he was doing. And that got a lot of things going in my head about scientific questions that needed more attention in research plots. And in short order, we had an experiment in place.
So Dick was saying that there's an actual economic benefit to having a 5-year rotation I think it was corn, bean, corns, oats, hay. He said there was an actual economic benefit to doing it that way in terms of yield and production costs and then crop value compared to conventional corn, bean rotation. Did you do a comparison?
Yeah, we've done economic comparisons over a period of 2003 through 2011, and we're working on the 2012 numbers now. What we find is that in these more diverse rotation systems that include oats and alfalfa or oats and clover, we can see huge reductions in input costs, mostly for fertilizer, because we don't have to purchase nitrogen. We can get it from biological fixation. But we also are able to reduce our use of pesticides. And another thing that has been quite startling is that our corn and soybean yields have gone up when our chemical inputs have gone down. And other people have observed that more diverse rotation systems tend to promote higher yields of corn and soybean. There are a lot of things going on with the biology in the soil that can contribute to that. You get reductions in root diseases on soybeans, and you get some interesting physical effects that promote root growth in corn and soy.
Are those things that you investigate in
detail? Those are things that we measure, and the effects are quite striking. So we get higher corn and soy yields at a lower production cost. We grow corn and soy less frequently in the longer rotations. So when corn and soy are worth a lot of money relative to hay and small grains, you have to take a systems approach and say, well, are we making more money over the course of the whole rotation, over the whole farm? And the answer is, in the last period of time from 2006 through 2011, we were actually making more money, more profit. So every farm is different, but I think diversity can contribute to reduced production costs, higher yields, and increases in net returns.
I just think that. You've demonstrated that.
Yeah, and we go out and publish it in scientific journals that are peer-reviewed by people who scrutinize our numbers. So this is not just a good idea. This is backed up with a lot of data.
Well, congratulations on your award.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming by.
Yeah, my pleasure.
My name is Matt Helmers, Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering at Iowa State University. And this year we're leading a workshop looking at strategies that we can use to reduce nitrate in our water, reducing export of nitrate primarily from tile-drained lands. So we have a suite of presentations by both researchers as well as practitioners to describe some of the practices that we can use. Farmers put on fertilizer for corn crops, but because of the timing of the rainfall event, we have water that moves below the crop root zone, and that water takes nitrate with it. Nitrate is soluble in water, dissolved in water, so it moves to shallow groundwater. It's not really surface runoff that's carrying nitrate. It's actually water that's moving through the profile to a tile line or to shallow groundwater. And so we're really looking at methods to reduce that concentration of nitrate that gets to shallow groundwater or tile drainage, or reducing that concentration once it's in the stream or exiting.
How much of Iowa farmland is drained by tiles?
That's a great question. We don't have a real good estimate. We can estimate it based on the soil characteristic, whether we think that soil would respond to drainage and thus somebody would have put in drainage. And the history of drainage is quite interesting. The use of subsurface drainage in Iowa is over 100 years old. A lot of historical meetings around the 1905 with a lot of talk about drainage. In fact, they talked about one of the most important things is to keep a record of where our drains go. But some of the estimates are maybe 9 million acres of cropland in Iowa have artificial subsurface drainage. These would be areas that would have been wet. And so in a lot of these areas, if it wasn't for drainage, we'd see significant crop production declines or maybe the inability to grow crops. As I talk to drainage contractors, the majority of the fields where they put in tile, they hit old tile. They hit old clay tile. We put in a couple drainage water quality research facilities while I've been at Iowa State. And in both of those cases, we did not know really about tile in these fields. And when we went in and put new tile, we hit a lot of tile. In fact, one of the fields, we hit tile at 2.5 foot and 3.5 foot depth. So sometime in the last 100 years, it's probably been tiled one or two or three times. There's a whole wide range of size of tiles. You know, some might drain an individual field and exit right to the stream. And then within areas of north central Iowa, we have what are termed drainage districts, where 80 or 100 years ago, the landowners in those areas came together to pay for a common drainage outlet. And so you may have 500 to 4,000 acres that all contribute to the same drainage main. The outlets of those big drainage systems provide, in many cases, an opportunity to install a wetland that could treat that water and remove a significant amount of the nitrate in that water, convert it from nitrate to nitrogen gas. On the smaller scale, where maybe it's not possible to outlet to a wetland, then we're looking at things like subsurface drainage bioreactors, where we route a portion of that drainage water through a wood chip trench. And we're also promoting denitrification. The microbial process consumes that nitrate carbon from the wood chips and converts to a nitrogen gas. So on a smaller scale, maybe 40 to 100 acres may be possible for one of these bioreactors.
Bioreactors is a very fancy name for a wood chip pile.
Yep, it's a wood chip trench. So they are engineered to certain design specifications, but it's a simple process. And so if we think about the installation of those, that's something that a lot of our land improvement contractors in the state of Iowa can install. The real question with all of these is, what are the benefits to the producer beyond just that they're doing something that has a positive impact on downstream water quality? Our soil system is, in my mind, the most vital natural resource we have in the state of Iowa. We need to do all we can to protect it, and I think it's in producers' best interest to protect that resource, to protect their livelihood, no matter the producer. But as we look at some of these practices for nitrate reduction, some of them may not have a direct positive economic impact for the farmer. A bioreactor really just treats nitrate. I'm an engineer, and even I don't find a bioreactor that exciting to look at. It's a wood chip trench, and we cover it with soil and plant grass on it. Wetlands are one that, while they might not increase the economic value of the crop production out in the field, provide some aesthetic value or wildlife habitat or some positive impact on downstream water flow to reduce some of the peak flows. So there's some other benefits beyond just nitrate. If we start to look at some of the practices like cover crops, it may be difficult to document a short-term economic benefits. But over time, those cover crops may help provide benefits to the soil, improve soil health, improve soil quality. If we have more organic matter in the soil, more carbon in the soil, we maybe can store more water in that soil or move the water into the soil at a faster rate. If we can store more water in our soil, then when we have years like 2012, we might have more water available for the plants, for crops. And so that may be difficult to document in a short term, but over a long term, things like cover crops that reduce nitrate leaching may help us with reducing surface runoff, may also help us with improving the resiliency of our system. At the PFI conference, our workshop on conservation systems for nitrate reduction is on Friday, but then there are some other talks related. There's going to be a cover crop 101, I think, on Saturday, and then Saturday morning is Tony Thompson, a farmer from up in southwest Minnesota, and he's implemented a lot of these practices. He's a really progressive farmer, and he was featured on CNN for what he's doing to try to help reduce nitrate export to downstream water bodies.
Well, thank you very much, Matt.
You bet.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the conference specifically. Soil and the Soul, what a lovely name. What prompted this specific topic for your conference title?
Well, there's nothing more basic than our soil. It sustains our life. It's the thing that farmers talk about most. It's something kind of cool that we've done for the conference. We've gathered soil samples from a variety of our farmers' farms, some of the ones who had pill days this summer. And we'll have those soil samples with some information about each farm at the conference so people can see the different soil types. When I moved back to Iowa from Washington, D.C. about 16 years ago, I was so struck by the black chocolate cake type soil. I'm still just astounded that so many people, farmers, would leave it uncovered and let it blow away. We have a long ways to go, as everyone will notice as they travel the countryside, but boy, there is a lot of interest in cover crops and keeping your soil covered, and we're really working to build that momentum.
Could you tell me a little bit more about some of what you're offering?
Sure. We have, on Friday afternoon, we have longer sessions. They run all afternoon, and that's to allow people to get more in-depth into issues. We have an expert named Greg Judy coming in to talk about leasing land and custom grazing. That's a big topic. And then we have someone coming in from New York State, Klaus Martens is his name, and he's talking about small grains and what he's done to make them profitable in his system. This would be grains like wheat, barley, oats. We have a really interesting session on smoothing the path to generational transfer. Just think about transitioning a business to your offspring. That's highly charged. But a farm is often even more so. There's something visceral about our commitment to land. I know there is in my family. I'm not about to sell the farmland that I will inherit. And everyone seems to feel that way. So there are lots of issues for the families to deal with. And I admire all those who try to establish a business with their fellow family members. I'm not sure I would.
Can you tell me the dates of the conference? There are things that people can still sign up for, and how would they do that?
Absolutely. It's January 10th through 12th. January 10th and 11th are the short courses. And then January 11th, which is a Friday, starting at 12:30, the regular conference starts. And it runs through Saturday the 12th at 5 p.m. And it is at Sheman Auditorium in Ames. Going on our website is a good way to sign up. practicalfarmers.org. That's all one word, practicalfarmers.org. And registration is still open. We already have 450 people registered, so we're looking at a huge crowd.
For those people without a computer, is there a phone number they can call?
Yes, 515-232-5661, or you can stop by our office, 600 5th Street, Suite 100. If you're from Ames, you'll know it as the old Social Security building. People still come in looking for that. So you can stop in anytime 9 to 5 and register there.
That's great. Is there anything else that you would like to tell us?
Yes, there is one other thing I wanted to say, and this is probably the thing I'm most proud of this organization. Last year, we had more than 250 people take a leadership role in this organization. They either held a field day, they served on a committee, they were a speaker at a conference, a variety of different ways they participated in this organization. And I think that is the true strength of this organization and the reason it will succeed in its vision of an Iowa where we get back to a diversity of crops and livestock and strong connections between farmers and non-farmers and a support for our landscape, for our clean waters, for biodiversity on our farms.
Thank you, Teresa, for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
One thing that I'd want to say, too, that I think has been important to the success PFI has had is that, generally speaking, we've had the support, and in some cases just the tolerance, but that's enough, of the other organizations in Iowa farming, the mainline general farm organizations. It was necessary, it seemed to me, to maintain a good relationship with all of these groups, because as we know, when people aren't familiar with something, when you leave some blanks there that are unfilled in their understanding, they will think the worst thing possible. This is human nature. And so you don't want to leave those blanks there. You want to make sure they know what's going on, and to the extent you can, you want to involve them in what you're doing. As the years have gone by, the organizations that didn't necessarily care that much about what we did, nevertheless, weren't afraid of us. They didn't think we were some kind of a movement that was going to be a problem for them. And in some cases, one case in particular, the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation played a very key role in the development of PFI.
Really?
They did. We had 7 employees at one point, all of whom were working for the board of directors because we had no executive director. In order to have an executive director, essentially, you have to have income from other than research grants, because research grants typically don't pay for staff that's not working on the actual project. So they all work for the board of directors, and if an organization is to grow, is to become financially sound, it has to have somebody coordinating all of the staff activities, not the board of directors, because they aren't there every day, they can't do it, and so we had to solve that problem. We needed an executive director. So we went to the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, had a meeting with its president, and asked them for a 3-year grant so we could hire an executive director, and they did it. And that was key. From that point on, the whole thing just blossomed. And it's been hasn't stopped or looked back since. We've been fortunate in the people we've had in that position of executive director. We've got a dandy one now. But in any case, the Iowa Farm Bureau was there for us in a very critical moment.
I think a lot of people would put you two in vastly different categories.
But we're not. The Farm Bureau recognized at the time that it was in their interest, because they had members who were exploring these kinds of things. It was their interest to support something that their members wanted to check out, wanted to get involved with. It was good for them, too. So, I mean, there was something in it for both of us, and that's always the basis of a good relationship. I was standing at the back of the room during a PFI business meeting, during the annual meeting, 10 or 15 years ago, and standing beside me was a professor from the University of Missouri, mm-hmm. a rural sociology professor. It was mentioned on the program that Farm Bureau had made this grant, and this professor turned to me and says, "This is amazing to me." He said, "In Missouri, we can't even use the term sustainable agriculture. It's too politically charged. People are at each other's throats when those various organizations mm-hmm. there. I don't understand how this can be so much different in Iowa." Well, if you pay attention to your relationships, it's possible for it to be good for everybody.
Well, that's the theme of the whole organization.
It is.
The relationship with the land.
Exactly.
And each other. And that's
you got
very interesting.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio. Today we have been talking about Practical Farmers of Iowa. We have been speaking with Teresa Opheim, Larry Collum, Dick and Sharon Thompson of PFI, Helen Gunderson of Ames, and Matt Liebman and Matt Helmers of Iowa State University. You can find more information at practicalfarmers.org. or call 232-5661. That's 232-5661. Reporters who contributed to this show have been Deborah Bunka and Greta Anderson. Technical assistance has been provided by Richard Morrison. Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison. Music you heard included The Farm by Jefferson Airplane, Howdy Neighbor by Judy Garland, The Farmer's Song by Leipers Fork Bluegrass, She Blinded Me with Science by Thomas Dolby, and Iowa by Dar Williams. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this song and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. You will also find lists of our guests and contact information to the organizations we speak with and other resources mentioned on our shows. If you have enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Your participation as audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.